With Redefine Ed, I'm Travis Pillow. Some charter school advocates have begun calling out their own side. Specifically, they're calling out virtual charter schools for what one report recently called large-scale underperformance. On this episode of the podcast, we're talking with Todd Zebarth. He is the lead author of that report and a senior vice president with the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools.
Hello and welcome to Redefine, your home for news about parental school choice and education reform.
The National Alliance came out with a report outlining a number of issues with virtual charter schools and calling for changes aimed at addressing what you all described as sort of systematic underperformance. I look at this report and I sort of see a pattern between last year at the National Charter Schools Conference where Nina Rees called out attention to the backfilling issue, and a couple weeks ago where the National Alliance joined some civil rights groups in coming out with a statement on special needs and discipline issues. And now this report, it seems like there's sort of a pattern of the National Alliance sort of holding its own side and holding the charter school movement to a higher standard. Is that part of what you all are trying to do here?
Yeah, I think we want to do a couple of things, right? I think we want to celebrate the gains and the successes we're seeing all across the country, and I think we do that on a consistent basis. But at the same time, we want our schools to continually get better and improve. And part of that is, looking at the data and finding out where there might be some challenges. And I think in those areas that you mentioned are places where we've seen some challenges emerge. And, I think we have two choices. We can put our heads in the sand and kind of pretend challenges don't exist. And I would argue the existing system did that for too long. Or we can own up to some of the challenges we're seeing and try to work as a community to address them.
With virtual charters specifically, I know that you all put out a report last week. Could you just briefly summarize sort of what it is that prompted the report and then what you're recommending to address it?
So we have been looking at this issue for some time. There have been an increasing number of news articles from such outlets as the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, government agency reports that have pointed out problems with full-time virtual charter schools. And so we began doing our own investigation of the issue, frankly, as part of an effort to rewrite certain provisions of a model charter school law that we have. And as we were working on that last fall, Mathematica, the Center for Reinventing Public Education, and an outfit called Credo at Stanford University released three reports on full-time virtual charter schools, the most comprehensive reports to date on this issue, and I think laid out some major challenges, particularly chronic and widespread academic underperformance by these schools. And so at that time, we decided we needed to put together a call to action to state leaders and to authorizers of charter schools to make some changes to improve the performance of these schools. And I think right now there are already several states that don't even allow these options, and we think that's a problem. And one of our concerns was that some state leaders may react to this report by banning this option, and we think that's a problem. We think that this, and we think the data shows that it works for a certain segment of students. The problem is these schools are enrolling a lot more students who don't fit sort of the profile of the child who succeeds there. So we laid out six different policy recommendations having to do with authorizing and accountability, with enrollment, and with funding.
So I just want to raise a little bit of a bigger picture question, which is this idea that charter schools have performance contracts where if they don't perform academically, they get shut down. And and so there's that would lead me to believe that if you want to get into the virtual space or you want to sort of try new things or do innovative approaches with unconventional students, that charter schools could be well suited to that, and we see that a lot. For some reason, though, that model, the takeaway from this report is that that model isn't quite working in the virtual space, and so why is it that the virtual space is different from what we're seeing with bricks and mortar charters?
In terms of if you don't perform, you close, right? That piece of it?
Right, exactly. And then that being the basis for providing more sort of freedom and flexibility.
Yes, exactly. I think one of the tensions here is that There's that whole notion of, you know, banks being too big to fail 6 or so years ago during the financial crisis. And I think there's a notion, in some places at least, that maybe these schools are too big to fail. I mean, if one of these schools shuts down, that's 8 to 10 to 12,000 kids that doesn't have a school option. So these schools are, you know, they vary in size, but, you know, several of them, a lot of them, are serving thousands of kids. And so it's one thing if you close a school serving 300 kids. I mean, that's a problem, and you need to be concerned about what's going to happen to the students in those schools. We see charter associations across the country do things like provide school fares to the students in those schools that are going to be closed. And that's manageable for 300 kids, but when you're trying to close a school that's serving 8,000 kids, you know, the logistics around that are incredibly challenging. So I think that's one tension. Another is authorizers in a lot of states get fees from the schools that they authorized. And the notion here is that, you know, it costs money for authorizers to oversee schools. And so states have just said, we'll deduct, you know, let's say 3% from a school's per pupil operating revenue, give it to the authorizer to pay for its operation. Well, in some cases, authorizers, particularly if the school's serving thousands of kids, maybe get over-reliant on that money coming in and are hesitant to close a school because they're at that point saying goodbye to, in some cases, a pretty big chunk of their budget. So the incentives are screwed up there. They're set up to not support authorizers making the right decision, but instead set up to, you know, support them making the wrong decision and leaving a chronically low-performing full-time virtual charter open. Two of the biggest operators of these schools are for-profit entities, and, you know, their incentives obviously are to keep these schools open, and they've invested a lot of money in lobbyists in you know, the states in which they operate, and those folks usually go to work on authorizers and state leaders when closure decisions await. And, you know, we're seeing this in Nevada right now. The Nevada Charter School Authority, a statewide authorizer, is attempting to close three or four of the statewide virtual charter schools there that are chronically underperforming, and the operators, you know, have kicked into heavy-duty lobbying gear to try to keep those schools open. So it's hard when an authorizer tries to close any school for a lot of reasons. It seems to be even harder when it comes to closing these large full-time virtual charter schools.
I'm based in Florida, where here people who sponsor charter schools, and that's pretty much without exception, that's school districts,
yep,
they're capped. They're able to charge those charter schools up to 5% of their funding to, and it's intended to sort of cover the cost of keeping tabs on the charter school, monitoring their performance, giving them some support services and things like that. But from what you're saying, there are other states where the charter school sponsor might be charging significantly more, and then that becomes sort of a revenue source that then they don't want to lose, and therefore they don't want to close down a school that's underperforming.
Well, they're not charging more. I mean, 5% is probably on the high end, to be honest with you. Usually it's, you know, 2 or 3%. But if you just multiply that over 8,000 kids, let's say, that's a lot of money for an authorizer. And that creates a disincentive to close the school.
There has been some pushback against this report. And I think one of the things that's been lost in the pushback that you all have, you've already referred to in this conversation, is the fact that y'all don't oppose full-time virtual schooling.
Right.
And you want it to be there for especially students who are athletes or have special needs who really could use that more flexible option. So I look at the landscape in Florida. We have a full-time Florida virtual school. We have many of the, anyone who operates a virtual charter school in Florida, those companies are also operating district-run virtual programs. And so one of the things that you all recommend in the report is that states maybe consider exploring the possibility that maybe the best way to provide full-time virtual schooling is not through the charter school model. So in an environment where you have different ways to offer virtual school options to students, what are some of the advantages and disadvantages of having students in virtual charters specifically?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, one of the advantages is for the school is if they're operating within the confines of the charter law, they theoretically, at least depending on how good the law is, have more flexibility to operate than if they're operated as part of a school district, you know, program. And so from the operator perspective, you know, I think there's definitely benefit to have that freedom and flexibility. We would also hope that there's the added accountability that you get in the charter model. So it makes sense, you know, particularly, and this is one of the reasons we've supported this model for years, is because, We think the freedom and flexibility and accountability in the charter model is well suited to do some innovative things like explore virtual learning and figure out how to provide virtual learning in innovative ways to students. But this model's had a lot of years now to sort of run its course, and I think the results, unfortunately, well, the results are in, and I think they're unfortunate for the most part, which I think raises the questions around how do we ensure that this is available for the kids who are succeeding, but make sure that these schools are actually enrolling and serving a lot more kids better than they are right now, which gets to the policy recommendations. And I think one of them that really raises this issue of whether these should be charters or not is around enrollment criteria. In the charter model, charter schools are open enrollment. They have to serve every student who wants to enroll, assuming that there's a seat available. But I think one of the things that we've seen some districts do is have some enrollment requirements because they've recognized that the students who are most likely to succeed are the ones who are super motivated with super involved parents. And so I think, you know, we've thought of these as almost like maybe they're like statewide magnet schools where they can serve a certain number of kids and they have enrollment criteria in order to be able to get one of those spots. And so, you know, we've put that out there recognizing that some states will probably say, you know what, that's not going to work within the charter model because charters, again, have to be open enrollment, and we don't want to create an option in the charter model where somebody isn't open enrollment. So we're going to, again, continue to provide these options but do it outside of the charter law. And so, you know, I anticipate a number of states are going to probably move in that direction.
So now that point in particular is one that I think has gotten a lot of attention since the report came out. Not the idea basically that virtual schools should ensure that their students have the support they need in order to succeed in a full-time virtual environment where they sort of have to be self-directed. And that's something that some of the pushback is really focused on. And I have this statement from K-12 Inc. where they basically say that policies that restrict parent choice and or create perverse incentives for schools to turn away at-risk children or others deemed not likely to succeed should be rejected, and they have no place in the school choice movement. So it kind of seems like this raises a really sort of core philosophical question of,
yeah,
on the one hand, you don't want to be turning students away, but on the other hand, you want them to be in an environment where they do well, and how do you resolve that tension?
Exactly. I think that is the question. And you gotta take a step back and remember where K-12's coming from here. It's a for-profit company. Bottom line, more kids they serve, more profits they make. Anything that restricts any student from enrolling in one of their schools, they will fight to the death. The bottom line is they want to be able to serve as many kids as possible, and this particular recommendation would make that difficult. And so, but I do think if you kind of remove their own self-interest from it, which I think we can do, I think there are other people in the charter movement who don't have the self-interest that they do of making profit, who you know, I think have some legitimate questions about this notion of, do we really want to have charter schools have enrollment criteria? And we sort of share that concern, which is why we're saying maybe they shouldn't be charter schools. You know, the reaction from the K-12s and the others sort of reminds me of the teachers' union's reaction. When you criticize a particular teacher, they often say, you're anti-teacher. It's like, no, I'm not anti-teacher. I just have a problem with this particular teacher. And I think we're sort of seeing the same thing in the reaction to this report from some people. Is we're actually supportive of full-time virtual education for kids. We think states need to absolutely make that available. We're just trying to figure out what is the best way to make this available so more kids succeed than are succeeding now. Remember, the data shows a student who enrolls in a full-time virtual charter school basically learns nothing in math compared to their traditional public school counterpart over a year, and they only learn half as much in reading. I mean, to me and to us, those are very problematic results and should motivate us to say, again, how do we preserve this option but make sure it's a heck of a lot more successful for more kids.
And so you mentioned that there are some states that are likely going to be looking at these recommendations very closely and possibly following through on them. I know that one of the big three states, you mentioned that the big three states for virtual charters are Ohio, California, and Pennsylvania. One of those, Ohio, happens to be in the midst of a big overhaul of its charter school system and its authorizing system.
Yep.
And it looks like a lot of these virtual charters might get caught up in that. Should we be keeping an eye on Ohio, or are there other states where we should be keeping an eye on attempts to make changes in the wake of these findings that have come out?
Yeah, I think Ohio is definitely one of them. Pennsylvania is another one of the big three states, and this issue is being debated there. And, you know, I would expect we might see some action in that state on this issue over the next couple of years. California right now, the third sort of state in the big three, there's a bill that would actually ban for-profit operators of full-time virtual charter schools. I don't expect that bill will go anywhere this year, but it just shows that that's an issue on policymakers' mind there. I mentioned Nevada earlier. The state's trying to close a handful of these schools. Sometimes that then spills over into legislative action, so I would keep my eye on Nevada as well.
Another one of the tensions that we seem to be seeing here is, and you mentioned in California, for-profit operators are sort of under attack, is that it kind of, it's often said sort of within the school choice movement that there's nothing inherently wrong with making a profit, but then there's also the realization, and I think you've raised it several times here, that the for-profit operators tend to have a different set of incentives, and they want to enroll as many students as possible and grow as quickly as possible. And so it seems like really the question that you're raising here is, who is going to safeguard the public interest if we're going to allow those operators to be involved?
Yeah, and we have, again, in addition to supporting full-time virtual education from day one, we've supported the ability of a charter school governing board to contract with a for-profit management company. I mean, I can take you to schools all across the country where those schools are doing well. And that's the most important thing. If the school is doing well and they're making a profit at the same time, you know, I think that's fine. If the school is doing poorly and making a profit, that's a problem. And it's not because the school's making a profit, it's because the school is doing poorly and if it's being allowed to stay open, that's very problematic. And I think that's what we're seeing here in the full-time virtual space with too many schools that are doing poorly and making a profit. But the thing that's motivating us to action isn't the profit-seeking nature of the operators. It's the fact that their schools are lousy. And in fact, we've sort of, one of our reactions to some of the pushback has been the best way to push back on this report is to improve your schools. You run better schools. You have schools that get much better results. We're not even having this conversation about policy recommendations. Right, if these schools got the similar results to some of the charter management organizations we're seeing across the country, or some of the independent mom and pop charter schools that are doing really well, we wouldn't even be having this conversation right now. So I think it's about the lack of strong results from these schools that's pushing us to say, hey, let's look at this. Now within that, though, you're right. Once you start to kind of peel back the layers of the onions, you sort of see the crazy incentives that are being created by for-profit operation of really large schools across states. But again, I would say one reaction is going to be, let's ban for-profit operators, and we would say, well, let's not do that, but let's make these other policy fixes to make sure the right incentives are in place if we are going to allow them to continue to operate schools.